Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo and Literary Director of the Library of Congress Marie Arana explore the themes of their roots, their creativity, and how their origin stories feed them and their work. This conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022 at the inaugural American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
We begin today with an extraordinary conversation about breaking boundaries and forging new paths with the inaugural Literary Director of the Library of Congress and the most recent Poet Laureate of the United States. In 2019, Joy Harjo became the first Native American to hold the position and the second person to serve three terms in a row. Harjo's 9 books of poetry include An American Sunrise, Conflict Resolution for Holy Beings, How We Became Human, New and Selected Poems, and She Had Some Horses. She's also the author of 2 memoirs, Crazy Brave and Poet Warrior, which invites us to travel along the heartaches, losses, and humble realizations of her poet warrior road. She has edited several anthologies of Native American writing, including When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, a Norton anthology of Native Nations poetry, and Living Nations, Living Words, the companion anthology to her signature Poet Laureate project. She is a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, Board of Directors Chair of the Native Arts. Maria Rana is a Peruvian-American author of nonfiction and fiction, as well as the inaugural Literary Director of the Library of Congress. She is the recipient of the 2020 Literary Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Among her recent positions are Director of the National Book Festival, the John W. Klug Center's Chair of the Cultures of the Countries of the South, and Writer-at-Large for the Washington Post. For many years, she was the Editor-in-Chief of the Washington Post Book Review section, Book World. Her sweeping history of Latin America, Silver, Sword, and Stone, was named Best Nonfiction Book of 2019 by the American Library Association and was shortlisted for the 2020 Andrew Carnegie Medal of Excellence. As an extension of the conversation started from our My America exhibit, Marie and Joy will be having a conversation to explore the themes of their roots, their creativity, and how their origin stories feed them and their work, which is inherently the story of American writing. So please help me welcome to the stage Joy Harjo and Marie Arana.
It's such a joy to be at this inaugural festival of the American Writers Museum. I have been a supporter of this museum since it was first an idea in Malcolm O'Hagan's head, wherever he is, Malcolm. So it's a real pleasure to see everything come to life and at this initial festival, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I'm enjoying it just seeing you in the room and being here with Joy, which is such a pleasure. We've known each other for a while, but this is the first time we're going to have a conversation, Joy.
Yes, it is, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am too.
And to being in Chicago, I realized while we were waiting back over here that the 2 longest poems I've written are about Chicago or take place in Chicago. So who knows what will come out of this.
Yeah, there's a special magic about Chicago. I went to school at Northwestern University just down the road, and there's something about it. It's such a writer's city, and it's there's a combination of the high rises and the lake and the really generous, big-hearted people in Chicago. It ain't that way in Washington, D.C., I will say. So let's start, Joy. We've made a pact that we're going to ask each other questions. I'm going to ask about Joy's most recent book, but also just in general, her career. And she will ask me 5 questions on whatever she enters your mind, Joy. So I want to start by asking you about the beginnings, about the origins. You began adulthood even before your time as a very young mother, and you describe that in this wonderful book. And you soon learned that you had an aptitude for caring and healing, and you thought that you might be a pre-med student. You thought you might go on to actually care for people in a biological way. And you soon threw it all behind you and to write and to heal and to care for souls as opposed to bodies. And I want to ask you about that decision and about that that calling. How did that come to you?
Well, yeah, I haven't thought about that in a while, about that decision, but I remember I was, yeah, I started out in pre-med with a minor in dance, but I had gone to the Institute of American, my high school was the Institute of American Indian Arts. Our curriculum was mostly, I was a drawing major, and wound up in the first all Native drama and dance troupe, taking dance and so on. And then I went to the University of New Mexico, and I was in Santa Fe, and I got a job as a nursing assistant, and I really vibed with that. And I was going, when the nurses weren't available, they were sending me to assist the doctors because I had an aptitude for it. So I decided to go to the university, and I was pre-med one semester. And I discovered that I didn't know what I was doing in chemistry. It made no sense to me at all. Math, I was doing my work but not turning it in. And go figure, I don't know what was, it was my first semester. And then I went back into the art studios because that's all of my life. I was in, I had my art on exhibit, in shows and cetera's, you know, sixth grade and so on. But the poetry thing really surprised me because it came out of one. I always loved reading and I always loved poetry and I loved my local library, which was part of a strip mall, and hung out there. And but it was knowing that it was becoming part of Native rights movements as a member of Kiva Club, the Native Student Club, and it was also meeting real Native poets and realizing, oh my, wow, you know, I loved Emily Dickinson, I loved all this poetry, but my image of a poet was an old white man in England, because that's what we were reading mostly at school at that time, which was fine. I loved the poems, because poetry can speak across culture boundaries. I mean, there's language can get in the way, but it you know, it has that power. But to meet Native poets, you know, I knew Leslie Marmon Silko, the novelist, first as a poet. Her poetry, and then her short stories, and then her novels. Simon Ortiz, James Welch, and that's when I started writing. And it took over, and I still don't understand. I mean, we didn't grow up with poets in our neighborhood. We did not grow up hearing ourselves as part of poetry. Rather, it was something the teachers were afraid to teach. And then I came to learn how poetry is always there at transformational moments, and we were certainly in a transformational moment at that time in history, just like we are now. And poetry becomes a poem becomes a kind of transformer station to make a shift, to change, to make a place, where you can communicate without words, but absolutely with words. Yeah. And what about you? I've been reading your American Chica and just blown away by how so early you were a storyteller. You know, I'm not really a warrior. It's poet warrior. My editor came up with that name, which really works. But you were really a story warrior. I was really blown away with those, you know, with in your relationship with Antonio and the way that you would in your, you know, childhood would at 5 years old. She was telling him all these stories, and he was kind of a story keeper himself of his indigenous stories, but there you were as a five-year-old sitting on a rock and telling him all these Greek myths and other stories that you had, you know, had been told or probably read, you know.
Thank you, Joy. Yeah, I grew up. I was born in Lima, Peru, but I grew up in a very small little sort of village north of Peru, about 8 hours drive up, and it was basically the Pacific Ocean and sugar fields, cornfields, and temples all around me. We didn't even know that there were temples around us when we were living there because they hadn't been excavated yet. but I'm so convinced that they were a kind of galvanic power because I was attracted right away as a child to the indigenous stories, and I didn't know why, but I later learned that I am quite, have a great deal of indigenous blood myself, and so the blood was singing to me, and I didn't know that it was. And just the power of words didn't come to me right away. It was the music of words. And I know, Joy, you, who is a musician as well, I started thinking that I was going to do music because that was, and dance. Music and dance were my passions. And I didn't realize that it was a early form of telling stories, of actually communicating, of trying to get across your feelings, your passions, your emotions. And so that's how it began for me. We didn't go to school, we were home taught, and there was such freedom. I just remember learning about myths and having my mother read poetry to us on a beach with the wind in our hair, sort of thing. It was a wonderful childhood. And then, of course, as time went by, they started finding these temples around us. There was a, right next to where I grew up, was the temple of the Señora de Cao, who was an early, before the Moches of Chimú, queen. So it was a matriarchal power there. And her temple was decorated. She herself was entirely tattooed. She with snakes and spiders, and the temple was entirely snakes and spiders. And now I think to myself, how astonishing that I grew up with all of that sort of magic around me. Thank you, Joy.
Yeah, but I think it's the same here. As I was thinking while we were waiting backstage again, looking at the trees and thinking about the keepers of these lands and how, you know, we all have keepers. We were born with them. I was present at the birth at my grandchildren. I've been present at most of their births, and someone always comes in to be with them. And it's the same with the plants. It's the same with the stories. I'm beginning to realize that stories and poems, in a way, have their own, the realized ones have their own, they want to live. I've learned that watching, being a great-grandmother at a relatively young age, I've learned that DNA wants to live, that the stories, you watch people and bad habits and wonderful traits, you know, emerging because they want to live. So I wanted to start, too, with saying, Maro, thank you to the keepers of these lands. Some of them are two-legged people, and some are, you know, the guardians. We all have guardians. The city has a guardian and a certain kind of spirit. You know, this isn't New York. This isn't Washington. It has its own place. And part of that is the song of the lake, which is, or the poem of the lake. And so on, and we are living in it, and it's, you could call it magical, but it's also just how things are. It's another way of seeing things. And so I was thinking too about, okay, that's what I was going to say, is that, yeah, that it's very much so, it makes a lot of sense that these, you know, as children, you know, we watch our children and how they're so utterly creative because they haven't built up the architecture for of belief systems that don't always support what they know innately. And that's where literature comes in, and that's where fiction and all kinds of, it comes in because it opens those doors. It opens awareness. It opens, you know, like reading, you know, there I am in Peru. There I am in that storytelling. And that's what literature does.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking also, as you're speaking, of a question that I wanted to ask you about orality. You know, you talk about orality in this book. And you play the saxophone, you play the Indian flute, music is very much a part of your life, but that there's something that you speak about in this book that is so connective to me, and that is that there's a difference between seeing what you call the tangle of words on a rectangular page and actually feeling the poetry move through your body. It's almost like your the singing, the orality, the oral tradition of Native American people and indigenous people on my part, that in Spanish we call it testimonios, because you're actually speaking from the heart, and it's the words are going through you, and you are almost singing. And I wanted to ask you about that orality and the oral tradition and the fact that when I read your poetry, it feels like singing.
Yes, I just read it was an essay I wrote. It was just named Bob Dylan Center Artist in Residence, and it's in Tulsa. Yeah. And I read an essay that I wrote for a book that's coming out on Bob Dylan, you know, pieces from the collection. And it was called Tangled, and everybody thought it was a poem. And I kept saying, no, it's an essay. But I realized, I think, while writing Poet Warrior and going back, as I wrote, to Indian school, is that all the students there were within a generation of rurality. That was in the late 60s. And in our classrooms, yes, the school was not the Indian school. You know, Deb Holland was instrumental in opening up, making that report on all the children buried at Indian schools. So that Indian school had that history, because sometimes the students would hear the little kids who had been ripped out of their mother's arms crying still years later, years and years later. But that school was an experiment in Indian education. And with the arts. But we had students there, we came from all over the country. And anyway, before I forget, so in those classrooms, we still had stoves against the wall that were used just a few years before to teach Native women, to teach the girls how to clean an apartment and run a stove and so on to work for people in town and the dairy farms. The remnants of the barns were still out in the back of campus for teaching the boys dairy farming. It was not that long ago. Our school was different. It was an experiment in Indian education, which the main curriculum was arts. So we had students from all over the country. I remember a student, Barbara Smith, who was from Chicago, Chippewa. And we had students from all over. But as I was thinking that almost everyone knew their language, came from living cultures, and so that orality, how you spoke, said something, even every day, it was kind of important. I mean, we were kids too, but there was an attention to language. And it seemed like everyone wrote poetry. I didn't write poetry then, but I got in trouble and got put in my own classroom by myself for writing dirty limericks about the teacher. And then I wrote songs for the acid rock band, all Native acid rock band that never went anywhere. And I realized as I thought about that, it really gives you a different kind of sense of you know, poetry. I remember going to Medellin to that huge poet, one of the biggest poetry festivals in the world, and the whole community came out in a huge, huge arena to hear poetry. Just regular people, like you were going to a football game. And then they would take us in groups, and I was in a group that they took us to an amusement park. Can you imagine somebody going maybe to the Navy Pier or, you know, to an amusement park here in town or saying, or during a football game, we're going to hear poetry, you know? But poetry, it was because of the orality that was still present in those communities where people went to poetry, they listened to it. It wasn't how we were taught that, okay, we might be given, a poem, say by, let me think, you know, we might be given a poem, any poem, and said, okay, tell us what it means first. And we're kids in school, and we've not had this kind of, it can be a different kind of language or different approach, rather than let's listen to this poem and see what emerges and what is there, and then read it another time, and then another time, and then come back a week later and read it, and then go from there.
So here's another question for you. I think of Langston Hughes and Audre Lorde and poets who actually, they're speaking for their people, as opposed to, let's say, Walt Whitman or E.E. Cummings, or poets who are not necessarily speaking for their people. You speak for your people. You are almost an ambassador, I think, of Native Americanness. And I wonder to what extent that feels like a mission, a obligation perhaps, or a joy. But you are always, it seems to me, representing your people in the way that I think of Cesar Vallejo in my country, in Peru, was representing the poor, the oppressed. So it's not always necessarily a race of people or an ethnicity of people, but you very much are a spokesperson for the Native American community, Joy. And I just want to ask you, to what extent did you take on that mantle and accept it and work with it I want to know where that comes from.
I think I'm the least likely person. And I remember being at, to do so, I don't think that I chose it. I remember being at the University of New Mexico and in that moment where I decided that I was going to leave art, which I loved. My grandmother was a painter, my Aunt Lois, who took her place because my grandmother died very, very young of TB, I didn't have to talk to people. I was extremely shy, and I could paint, and that was my way. And then this poetry thing took over, and I didn't understand it except that it was very urgent, and it took over, and I didn't understand that. I mean, what was I going to do with poetry? I was a single mother with two children and no help from the family because I'd been banished. So what was I going to do? But it was that strong. And I remember thinking, as we would go out into the communities, because they would ask, mostly Navajo and Pueblo communities there in Albuquerque, and we would go sit, you know, with their negotiations with uranium companies, because they called on us because we were going to the university, with coal companies, and listen to these incredible testimonies of people telling, the Native people telling about how they were part of the land and how these things they had, you know, that responsibility. And I think something about all of that, and then my family, I come from a family that fought against Andrew Jackson, part of the Red Sticks, against the illegal move. On my mother's side, they were sharecroppers. My dad's family looked down on them. I mean, there was something about all of this, and it's something even more that I don't understand, that I remember something was planted in me. And I remember thinking, if I do anything, when I get to the end of my life, and I'm a lot closer than I was then, is that I want Natives to be seen as human beings. Because I was familiar with the history, and I saw what went down. And it's interesting how that's come about, that I love my people. Somebody asked me the other day what I wanted to be known for, and I said, I want to be known that I love my people. Ultimately, we're all related, and I was walking in the airport yesterday, and I saw an old man who looked like my uncle, who's long gone, because all of my mentors are gone. They're still here in their words and what they planted in me. But I was really missing them, and I was, at least the mask, I could hide behind it and cry a little bit. and thinking, but you know what they taught was that we're all related. Those old people, you know, those old people who knew themselves, the earth is a living being, and knew that as the, you know, the in, you know, and lived in that, that we are, they said, we are all one people ultimately. We're diverse, we have all kinds of cultures, and sometimes they come up against each other, and even we come up against each, you know, ourselves. So I don't really understand it, except that I'm here. I realize that I'm here to for something that's, you know, larger than me. And then in Poet Warrior, I talk about, I have a great grandfather who has always been around me and being close to me, and I in the book I'm crying out, why am I this? I don't even look the part. I don't look like Pocahontas. I'm noticeable. I grew up in my community. I grew up in a community of Muscogee Creek people. They knew who I was and my family. I went to Indian school, fine, everybody, I fit in and everything. And it wasn't until I went to University of New Mexico, I was fine there until I wound up associated, or I didn't marry him, but with a Pueblo man. And that's when the division started, where it said, well, you Oklahoma Indians aren't real Indians, which is, you know, this whole thing, this whole schism that's destroying the country, because ultimately we are all related, and that's what I've been taught. So I don't know the answers, and I know that the poet laureateship made that front and center, and one of the best things to happen out of that laureateship is that the image for natives rejoiced because we were seen as human beings. You know, a poet is a human being. There are a lot of Native poets. Within a year, there were two anthologies of Native poetry that came out and said, look, I'm not the only poet. You know, there are a lot of Native poets. There are a lot of American poets. And I always want to thank Ishmael Reed, because he was the face for me of the beginning of kind of this notion of multicultural literature in this country, because the American canon had not included any of our voices at all up until that point in the 80s, when this revision of, you know, who is America came to the forefront.
That's so interesting. My experience was so different in so many ways. Even when I came to this country at the age of 10, and we were speaking Spanish at home, once I left that front door and went out into the world, I was trying very hard to be like everyone else. And I almost erased myself in the process. I went about starting my career, I went into publishing, I started by editing other people's books and bringing their stories to life, and then going over to criticism, running the book review section at the Washington Post, and even though jumping that fence from creativity to criticism, always working with other people's works and other people's voices. And there was a point at which, at the Washington Post, I mean, I was actually told who I was, which was very bizarre. I was just coming into my job at the Washington Post, and in the personnel section, the person who was receiving in human resources and looking at my information said, oh, you were born in Lima, Peru. And I said, yes. And they said, so that means you're Hispanic. And I said, well, yes. And they said, so you speak Spanish? And I said, I do. And they said, well, gosh, we have a big population of Spanish-speaking Latinos in Washington, D.C. And it suddenly occurred to me, this can be useful. What I was trying to erase can actually be useful. And it was at that point, you know, and aside from doing my job as the books person, then I went out and did stories for the paper on
on migrant workers and construction workers and this whole wave of people that were coming up from Mexico and going back to Mexico. And it was almost like a self-discovery. I was quite an adult by then. And it prompted me to go back and look for that 10-year-old girl who had come from all that way and had stories and an imagination of another world, and to try to dig that back up again. And that's really when I decided to start writing books, and that was, you know, 25 years ago. And then I realized that there was not enough literature that actually relayed to people who we are. We are so invisible in this country. We are so, and there are so many people like that little 10-year-old girl who went about the business of erasing who they were and where they had come from and the things that moved them and the stories, the mythology, the magic, the completely different way of thinking. And to just pull that back, and that has been my job ever since, is to pull that back and to put that down and to relay exactly where we've been, who we are, and we are very, very different people from the ordinary sort of American model that I was trying to become. Whereas you always knew and felt who you were, I lost that at the age of 10 and regained it many years later, and being told by a human resources person, look into who you are, use that. And so it was a little bizarre, but so welcome.
Yeah, I was wondering when you began writing, because you have such a long life of fostering other people's work, even your job recent Library of Congress, and that's a very different kind of mind than writing, and you're such a wonderful storyteller and writer. And I wondered, thanks for that story, because I wondered when that happened. And I wonder how you balance that, or how you find that, because one, it's sort of like your identity. There's one side, and I think about this a lot, there's one side and then there's another, and how do you bridge that? And is there a certain place that you do your writing? Do you have to cut all of that off and move into that space, or how do you maneuver?
It's a hat trick. You know, the two functions are so different. And you know this perfectly well, Joy, the creative function, you have to open your heart. You have to open your soul, your mind. You have to let things come in. And the editorial process and what I do for the Library of Congress is all judgment. And, you know, what's good? Where is the quality? And how do I relay this extraordinary work somebody else is doing? How do I shine a very bright light on that? And that's a very, very different part of the brain, I think. As a writer, though, I also think that there is a bridge that you cross when you write, because, and I know you must do this too in your poetry, you write and it's like a magma. I mean, you're throwing out this stuff, and it is, you're putting it down on the paper, and it's a mess initially. It's just a river, a sort of fire hose of emotion or of information. And then you go back, and you whittle it, and you whittle it, and you work on it, and you polish it, and you are using a different part of your brain for that part. So I think that if you're a writer, you do have those two parts. What you cannot do, however, and we were talking about this, is be an administrator and be a writer at the same time. So, you know, I've always had to shut that door and walk away from a job or from administration to actually sit down and be creative.
I appreciate you saying it's a mess.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people think poets, like, you know, you get this inspiration, and there it is, and a lot of times I'm sledging.
Yeah, it's supposed to be like the silver bullet, right, of language.
And right. And it doesn't know, sometimes I have a new poem called An Ordinary Day, and it just almost came like it was. Not quite. I'm still tinkering with it. But it used to bother, when I read that Mozart wrote everything down just as it was, that bothered me for a long time. That, okay, there's something wrong with me, that things aren't coming out, that I'm always having to revise. They don't come out right. And then I came to realize as I, you know, thought about that and walked around it and all of it was, well, that's because he had the kind of mind that he had trained his mind to do all of that mess in his mind first. And I thought, why can't I do that? You know? But it's just what it is. I like seeing it. I'm kind of a very visual, even as I'm very, you know, sound is really important, but I'm also very visual, so I like to see it. It's like even writing, when I improvise with music, it's like each of the, it's patterning. We're all about patterning. History is about patterning, looking at patterning, music, poetry, you know, even storytelling, there's rhythms and ways that you move about to make a story more effective. So my stuff comes out, and it's not always, there's moments. I remember once I wound up at Hopi Land to see some friend's daughter dance a buffalo dance. I was the butterfly dance. I was going out to do a writer residence thing at Tuba City High School, and I got up there, and suddenly the father had passed, and they were going to have a funeral. So I stayed to help. But I remember the morning they came to take his widow. Went with the family to bury him, and the children were there sleeping, and so I stayed there, and I remember I made a pot of coffee. I don't usually drink coffee, but I needed it that morning, and I sat there with a yellow pad of paper and wrote a poem called Wings of Night Sky, Wings of Morning Light, and it was about 5 or 6 pages. When I went to revise it, I think those were the only words that remained in the final poem. When I went to revise it, only one of the original lines was there. But what I was doing was kind of catching the spirit of the poem, in a way, like a net.
I want to ask you, in that vein, I want to ask you about this book, Poet Warrior, which is a memoir, but it is a very idiosyncratic memoir, because what you do, it's a combination of prose description of your life, and then this plunge into poetry, and the prose is a really harrowing moments in your life where you're struggling to get from one place to another, or to deal with hardships and trials of your life. And then the poems come, and the poems are almost like a salve. This hard life, and then this poetry, and then this more of the challenges of your growing up, your adulthood, etc. And then this wonderful voice that comes, the poetry, and that speaks to the life. And I wonder about your decision to write this book in that way, because it's very powerful. The way it's almost like call and response to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I call the creative process a call and response. I've been saying that a lot lately. So, I had no idea that it was going to wind up in the form it was. I just do what I do, but people don't always understand it. And for years, they didn't understand. It's like, what are you doing? You're not writing like so-and-so or so-and-so. You know, you're not doing these cool craft tricks and doing this and that. I just make my own way. So I didn't realize that's what I was going to do. I thought I was writing a real memoir. And then I do my own, as my editor, Jill Bialowski, says, you reinvented memoir. And But I was thinking, too, a lot of the books, you know, what inspired me that way is In Scott Momaday's The Way to Rainy Mountain, which was written in three different voices. And each voice was able to access, you know, another part of this story of becoming, of his becoming. You know, there's the mythical voice, there's the storytelling voice, there's the personal voice. And I've taught that book as memoir. I've always liked that kind of, and then the other part of the narrative are his father's images. And then Leslie Silko was storyteller, in which she, the shape of it is very much like a spider, like a web. And where all of the, she, you know, mixes images, stories, pieces of novels, etc., and puts them together in a whole. So those also really inspired me in writing memoir, in writing Poet Warrior. And the cover art is my daughter's beadwork, which features the water spider who carried fire when the world was flooded. And you know how hard it is to start a fire with wet, you know. So that's also a part of the story and speaks to the arrangement, of the stories.
I was so struck, you know, reading Joy's work about Native American symbolism and, you know, the reference to the earth, which is so strong in her work, is so much a part of my growing up. I mean, there is, I grew up around indigeneity. I mean, we were surrounded by the indigenous world, and its respect, the deep, deep respect for life, the land, the beauty of a seed, the rights of an animal to the earth as equal to the rights of a human. And so I read your work, I see the spider on her cover, and I think, you know, this is a symbol that I grew up with. We were thousands of miles apart. What? 3,000-4,000 miles apart. In our childhoods, in our growing up, in where our people lived. And sort of the, in my world, the colonial world was the evil. And in your world, of course, the Trail of Tears and the shunting was the evil, the pushing away. I am so taken by the similarities that of the symbolism and you must have felt that, and I know when you went down to the Amazon, because you describe it in this book, that you had always been sort of enamored of the concept of an anaconda in the Amazon. And of course, we have sort of mirror perceptions of the indigenous world. And I want to hear a little bit about your connection to the very far away world of a South American indigeneity when you were there.
Yes, I went to, I took a trip, I don't know, it wasn't based on, sometimes I go off when I go perform, but this one I went to Machu Picchu and then to, which and wound up in Cusco. And we went to a museum there and got a tour. And I remember seeing this stone lion. And I told everybody to go on. And I was in tears and did some acknowledgement there. Because what I saw, it's almost like the navel of the world. It's like the navel cord. I kind of saw the navel cord place of a lot of the Pueblo people, even my own people, and some of us, it shows that we're from the South, and because we're mound builder people and so on. And I could see in that old figure, and I have not been able to, every once in a while, late at night, I'll go on Google and try to find out something about that lion. I haven't been able to find anything. But I saw that deep, deep connection. And of course, the Amazon is one of the largest rivers, so of course it would be somehow in the consciousness of everyone somewhere in some little speck, because we are essentially the earth. And I've always wanted to go across the whole Amazon. And as a child, I was real into the Amazon and the animals. I mean, you know, who knows why we find those connections. But ultimately we are all connected. So who inspired you most? Who were the writers that made you want to write?
Oh my goodness. Well, lots of very different writers. I majored in Russian literature, of all things. And I was inspired by a great deal by Nabokov. But I was also, you know, growing up in Peru, I was inspired by Cesar Vallejo, poet who is so angry. And there was such suffering and anger in his voice. And I was very dramatic as a child, and I was drawn to anything that was sort of excessive and exaggerated. So I loved writers that could punch you in the stomach, and Cesar Vallejo was certainly one. I love Flannery O'Connor, inspired me deeply because, I mean, talk about being punched in the gut. Every story seemed to be a gut punch. Those were the writers that inspired me. But I also found, you know, in storytelling, and sometimes it wasn't any. Sometimes I was most moved by hearing somebody tell a story at a kitchen table, and just the way that a narrative moved, the way that it started sort of in a soft place, and then it drew you deeper and deeper and deeper until you were in a very profound sort of lagoon underground. I loved the way that ordinary people could do that. And I think that was probably the most, even though, you know, you study writers and they do influence you in so many ways, I was totally gobsmacked by the fact that Russian literature was so like Spanish literature. It was all about how wretched families could get. It was about how wretched love could get. It was about betrayal. It was about the lies and a kind of soul heaviness. And that was so much a part of my growing up in a Spanish-speaking world. But I found, Joy, that, you know, in ordinary people, I would listen to my aunts at the kitchen table talking, and their stories were so amazing I wanted to run and write them down. It was really human life itself. The ordinary people's stories were cataclysmic in a certain way. And those, I think, influenced me more than anything. How about you?
Yeah, that's why I sat under the kitchen table when my mother and her friends were talking, when I was told to leave.
Right.
Yeah, I love, as far as stories, Isaac Bashevis Singer. He's one of my favorite storytellers, I think, because he comes from morality, too. I mean, all of it comes from morality. Every short story, novel, or poetry, and so on, really has those roots in orality. Poetry has its roots in song making, and dance is always there too. But I loved his, and I borrowed his Gollum for my poem, Rabbit Is Up to Tricks, where Rabbit, who's the trickster, makes a person in the world who is very destructive, but who mirrors, you know, if a human makes a person, it's going to be ultra human. And will set about to destroy its maker, so to speak. But I loved his stories for that, and how they came from the people. And you know, I think about what you were saying about how humans, how, you know, we deal with the good, the bad, the ugly, the beautiful. I tend to be more of a romantic, and that could be my undoing, but I'm also at the same time, I see what's going on, and I think for writing for me too has always been a place to deal with contradictions, because contradictions don't sit easy in any of us. You know, democracy, cool. That comes from a culture that understands that we're all related. But then at the same time you're building democracy, you say, Africans and natives aren't part of it, you know, or to be policed differently or something. That's a contradiction of, you know, of what America is supposed to be, and so on. So that's why I go to writing or I go to poetry, not to make answers, but to explore what can be terrifying even.
That reminds me of the way you use dreams in your writing, and dreams often lead you to, dreams are full of contradictions. I mean, this happens all the time. Bizarre, strange things happen in dreams, but you seem to use dreams a great deal in your writing and your storytelling, Joy. How does that work?
I'm not sure, but and usually other people's dreams are pretty boring. But I had a dream the other night, and I'm still thinking about it, where, you know, I've always said I lived in Denver a short time because I said I would never live in Denver, and never is very powerful. So there I was. But I was around all this ski culture, people going skiing, why aren't you skiing? I said, I have no interest in putting two sticks on my feet, going out into the cold and going down a mountain. I said, water, different. And as soon as I lived in Honolulu, and immediately I was out racing canoes in the ocean. But in my dream, I had one ski and I figured out my own way. And I can't remember exactly what I did. It kind of sounds like, where you skate with a board, but it was different. And in the dream, I found my own way of skiing, and it was so exciting. Nobody else was doing it like me. And I was going up and down. It was a really nice dream. I said, I get this, but I had to find my own way. And there I was, just exhilarated. Now, I guess the meaning is kind of obvious. I do my own memoir. I've got a third one that I'm thinking about. But I've had other dreams. Some of them are waking dreams where, I learn a lot, or I go into, I had a grandmother, my mother's mother, who would dream whole novels. That's how she kept the kids, got them to go to sleep at night. And that's, my dreams are like that. I've been a lot of different people in my dreams. I remember once being in Cambodia, walking into a temple. Another time, I had a series of West African dreams. One, I was in this whole ceremony. It was one of the most profound dreams, because when I came to, I was sitting in an apartment with one of those old shag carpets where my kids, little crabs were lost in it for a week, And I said, what do I do with this? Because I was wide awake through all of this. And then later I thought, well, maybe it's DNA, it's the DNA or something. But some dreams are I just ate too much pizza. Some dreams are like, this is our warnings or other things, and some are just these stories, because we're all in an unwinding stories of our soul, of our family, of our country, of our community, of the earth, I think sometimes in dreams we just go dip into the story field, just like you're doing here. You're at this festival dipping into the story field. So I don't really understand. I've tried to figure out how it works. I've gotten nowhere with that. But so it's compelling. And I think that's what keeps me writing. And then I see the children and the grandchildren, and they're all our children. And it gives me, we're at these crazy times right now, and people are losing heart, I think some of the kids are. And we have to remember that this is a potent time in the story field, in which our stories and our poems are absolutely needed, because they will be, that will, they will be what helps people keep moving. through the hard parts. Yeah.
Do you think the world has gotten better in listening to diverse stories? There's a sense in publishing suddenly we're hearing from Muslim novelists, we're hearing from lots of wonderful African-American literature, we're hearing more and more Latino literature. Do you think there is an openness, or what do you think is going on in terms of our willingness as Americans to hear stories that might be different from the what we used to call the American ideal, the American dream, the American sort of notion of who we should be, the sort of the ideal person who graduates from a high school and goes on to do a career. And now we have these different voices. Do you feel it's connecting? Do you feel that that's working?
I think a good story is a good story, and once that image of NASA was released of the Earth as a being, it kind of opened up, you know, it opened up at a deep level, the super consciousness of all of us that, hey, you know, we are the Earth. But I think where we get into trouble is when somebody legislates or pronounces that there is only one story, and any other stories that counter that cannot be allowed. And that's happened in my community, where there was a state legislation that, you know, basically that's what it was. It was a warning that there is only one story, and if you say another story, include another story that happened in the community, then you will be, I didn't read what the punishment was. There's a lot of that going on, like when does a soul enter the body, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where you get into trouble, when you lock down imagination and you lock down the beingness of other, you know, of other stories.
There seems to be a backlash, yeah. That's even though in publishing houses you are getting a lot more diversity, there seems to be a very strong backlash now. And it certainly, as Carrie said at the very beginning, it's disturbing. It's something that you have to protect. It's something that you have to keep working at, I think. And it worries me, frankly. That worries me. I wanted to ask you about, and just to talk about a little bit about magic, because that is something that we both share in our cultures, the strong sense of magic, not necessarily something that is like a rabbit out of a hat, but it's the notion that, in my world at least, when you talk about magical realism, which is a term I really don't like, because when we do magic in my culture, in South American culture, Latin American culture, it is because very often real world slips into a kind of a magical, crazy thing. I mean, actually, severed heads do tumble out of bushes, because we've seen it in the violent cultures that we live in. Or women do float up into the sky, because you're told as a child when something horrible happens that's, you know, the angels have pulled the child up. Magic is a way of dealing with a very harsh and sometimes violent world. And I wondered how, when I read your poetry or this book, you suddenly, snakes are talking to you, and there are moments when you slip into a kind of different world, a magical world, an imaginative world. But I think what you're saying is very close to what we do in Latin America, which is, it's very real, the magic, in so many ways.
I think, for one, magic isn't all positive, some of it's negative. We live in a world that's very split, very a world of duality. And I think it has to do with frequency and resonance. Children live in magic. They create, something becomes something else. And despite what you may think, they really see what's going on. You might hide, you're fighting from them. You might, try to, but they know. Generally, they know what's going on. The natural world is a being to them. And then that gets shut off because we are trained to, work within certain frequencies. I think that's what it is. I mean, you can say, okay, there's eyesight, human eyesight. We've all seen those charts. And then, or sound, like a dog can hear, da-da-da. But people, we don't all fit right in the center. And I just think it's, that in some cultures, the frequency, it depends on how you're taught or some people are come in. But, right now, we're all on different, there's thinking is a certain kind of frequency. And it concerns me with this social media, everything has got two sides, but there's a certain frequency to that static. I know I study these in my own, in my own semi-addiction, I'm pulling away from stuff like that because, it's the frequency. I remember studying with the TV, with the television. I eventually got rid of it because I would feel the energy. I would go in and think, okay, and then I would feel how it shifted the energy and how we would lose our stories. We would lost our stories to the television. I saw it with my own kids. So I got rid of the television. And now the computer and the phone is so crucial and important, so it's like sugar, so how do you detach from it? But I guess, there's so much more that we could speak about here, but I know we're both appreciative to get to be here and with each other, because we hadn't gotten to speak with each other in this way, and then to be here with, people who love literature here in Chicago. So thank you.
Absolutely. That's magical. That is magic. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, visionary photographer Karel Augustus discusses his new photography book, Black Hollywood, Reimagining Iconic Movie Moments. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.